You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. So now to those 12 people, the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee. They meet this upcoming week, and they probably won't raise interest rates. At least that's what the market's betting. But as I mentioned at the top of the show, we are bringing on someone who has been in that room making the decision about rates and discussing a whole bunch of other things that, even though they can feel far away, have a big impact on you. He's Narayana Kotra-Lakota, the former president of the Minneapolis Fed and now an economics professor at the University of Rochester. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you today.
I want to start by playing a clip from Janet Yellen's speech last week. This is from the Q&A where she got asked, of course, about when the Fed might move on interest rates. Let's listen.
I know market participants really want to know exactly what's going to happen. And it is only on rare occasions when we're able to provide that kind of guidance. There is, as I said, about 18 times no preset plan.
So we get back to the mantra of data dependent, data dependent, data dependent. I want to know from you, this is a game we like to play here, what is Janet Yellen thinking going into these meetings?
I think it'll be really interesting to hear from her on that. I suspect she'll be more open to her ideas about that once she's no longer in the position. But I think that the general perspective of people who are coming into the meeting is there's a bunch of data flow coming through about a wide variety of economic conditions, and you're somehow trying to put that together into formulating a decision about interest rates. I think there's been a considerable amount of murkiness about what exactly is the committee trying to achieve. To be even a little more precise about that, you know, the committee has stated that it's trying to keep inflation close to 2%. Mm-hmm. Well, really, for the last 3 years, they've been engaging in that tightening of monetary policy, first by suggesting they were going to stop the buying of long-term assets, then stopping the purchase of long-term assets. These are purchases that are designed to put downward pressure on long-term yields and thereby stimulate spending and stimulate upward pressure on inflation. So you're taking a step backwards from your goal, even though you're not achieving your goal. And this has continued for quite some time. And I think this is a source of real confusion for market participants.
Well, yeah. I mean, you wrote not too long ago for Bloomberg View that, you know, investors and people like me are overly focused on when will they raise, when will they raise, and ignoring the larger goals. And I guess I wonder, you know, what are those goals now? Because this is not the traditional gas and brakes Fed that I think a lot of people grew up with.
Yeah, I think that what I was trying to suggest in that article is that it's the Fed's lack of clarity about its own goals that have created the lack of clarity among the public and people like yourself and among the market participants about what those goals are. I think that the challenge for the committee has been that for a long time, coming into the crisis, there was a certain rule of thumb that was a very good way to achieve good outcomes. And this was called a rule that has been named after and was originally described by Professor John Taylor of Stanford University. So it's called the Taylor Rule. What's happened is that Taylor Rule, which is describes how you should set interest rates given economic conditions, that has not been providing good outcomes for the Fed for a long time. So you have this tension between this long-established rule that the committee followed for many years and the committee's goals, which are described in statute as maximum employment and price stability.
The dual mandate.
And maximum employment basically means, you know, let's keep unemployment low. And then price stability means let's keep inflation close to 2%. What's been hard is inflation's been running very low, well below 2% for quite some time, 4 years at least. And nonetheless, the committee is in the process of tightening policy. And it's because of the tension between this historically useful rule of behavior and it's achieving its goals.
So is it safe to say that if you were still on the committee, you would want to loosen policy? You'd want to lower interest rates?
Yeah, that's pretty safe to say. I think it's just the problem is I think life is much easier and communication is much easier if you always act according to your objectives. So if you state you have a 2% inflation objective, the only way to keep that credible in the minds of your listeners is you always act in such a way that's consistent with that. So right now, the Fed has a 2% inflation objective, but inflation is running well below that, is expected to keep below that for, I think, for 3 years. So why tighten policy now? The right approach is to try to speed up the progress towards your goal of 2% inflation by lowering rates. And that could also be helpful, of course, on the employment mandate, because you'll actually get more jobs created as well.
Why do you think the Fed has been overly optimistic about the pace of the recovery?
I think that from a historical basis, this has been a slow recovery. I think there was a notion early on, especially if you go back to, say, 2009, 2010, there was a notion that because we'd had such a deep recession, that the economy would bounce back relatively rapidly. That turned out not to be true. And I think that's been a source of confusion for the Fed, but certainly for many other forecasters. It's not like if you go back to 2009 and 2010, there's a large number of macroeconomic forecasters look good for over the succeeding 5 years.
You know, you have been one of the most, I would say, significant examples of someone radically changing their mind in public office. You used to be against stimulus, saying that monetary policy couldn't really move the employment market. And then you've come around as really a super dove in Fed jargon. What was that process like?
You're charged as a member of the Federal Reserve Committee to achieve certain goals. The goals you're trying to achieve are to keep inflation close to 2% and promote maximum employment. When I was first on the committee, I had a vision or a model of the macroeconomy in mind where I thought inflation returned back to 2% despite the depth of the recession relatively rapidly. That model of vision of the economy proved to be wrong. And if you've got certain things you're supposed to be doing on the public's behalf, you have to be willing to admit, I think, that you're when you're wrong in order to be able
but
to
But not
make,
a lot
make
of people
policy.
In public life admit that they're wrong. I mean, was it scary to do that?
You know, nobody likes to admit they're wrong. On the other hand, the only way you can admit to learning is to, in some sense, admit that you've been wrong in the past. So I viewed it as just a positive growth opportunity for myself. Is I was updating what I knew about the economy, and somebody who was interested in being learning about the economy, as I've been for a long time, was a good thing to be able to do that. I think there has been different reactions from different people about my change in policy stance. In general, I think the reaction has been fairly positive, but I didn't do it with that in mind. I did it because it was my job to do what I could to achieve the goals of the institution.
What worries you about the economy right now? You know, we had this not great jobs report, though some people say it's a blip. The quits rate is not great. I mean, then there's a lot of kind of scary stuff out there when I think about maybe what could happen around the Brexit vote. You know, what are you watching?
So I watch two things, I would say, but I watch many things, of course, but I'll say I think there are two aspects that right now that give me great pause. So one is the measure of the Fed's credibility in terms of its achieving its 2% inflation target over the longer term. So if you look at where market participants are betting, where inflation is going to be over the next 10 years, over the next 5 to 10 years, well after the current FOMC is gone, frankly, they're not betting that the Fed is going to be hitting inflation, a 2% inflation goal over consistently over the longer term. This is a real problem for the Fed. Those lower long inflation expectations feed into interest rates and gives the Fed less room to help the economy if there ever shocks. So that's one source of concern. The other source is international. I think the U.S., there's certainly things we can point to in our economy, and I've done so, that are a cause for concern. But internationally, I think our major trading partners, Europe, China, Japan, Canada, are really struggling with their economic conditions, really struggling through economic weakness. Our raising rates, especially our tightening monetary policy, I think could really cause issues in their economies that would feed back and hurt us. So I think it's that international picture that is also quite troubling to me.
You know, the mission of this show is where the economy meets real life. And I can bet that there will be people who listen to this and say, wait, 2% inflation? What? Who are these people who go into a meeting? I want you to make the case for them that the Fed is something they should care about.
Yeah, I would actually say it's something more strongly. The Fed is basically one of the main forces that helps keep the economy stable. It's one of the aspects, as Americans think about who they should have as president, for example, one of the things we know that president will have the opportunity to do is appoint a chair of the Board of Governors in January 2018. Of course, that person will have to be confirmed by the Senate as well. That might be a decision, of course, to reappoint the current chair, Janet Yellen. that person will have an enormous influence on the course of the U.S. economy. Now, how does that work? It works through the fact that when adverse shocks hit the economy, the Fed, by lowering interest rates, has the ability to stimulate demand when other forces are pushing downward on demand. So that if there's a shock to people's housing prices, for example, the kind we saw in 2008, that kind of shock will lead people to cut back on spending. By lowering interest rates, the Fed is able to offset that shock. That helps to keep employment higher than it would be otherwise, and it keeps prices higher than it would be otherwise. Now, the lower inflation expectations are, the lower interest rates are on average, and that gives the Fed less room, essentially, to play this role of keeping the economy stable. So you have to become more worried about recessionary shocks feeding through into the economy if the Fed doesn't have as much room to help the economy.
Speaking of the election, Secretary Clinton says she wants bankers off the boards of the regional Fed banks. What do you think about that?
You know, I think it's really, you want to be really careful when you use the term banker. I think some people, when they hear the word banker, immediately think of, you know, the CEOs of the major firms on Wall Street. Most of the bankers that serve on Fed's boards of directors are really community bankers. They're leaders of relatively small financial institutions. I think it's very important for Fed presidents and also for the Board of Governors to hear from those members of the financial sector. They have a lot of opportunities to hear from the leaders of the large Wall Street firms. One way we could be clearer about this is to actually put an upper limit on the size of financial institutions that are represented on the boards of directors of the reserve banks, say $10 billion. And then I think it would be clear to everybody, okay, what we're talking about is community bankers and not CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase or Citibank or something like that.
I want to ask you about large banks. Your successor at the Minneapolis Fed, Neel Kashkari, would like to see big banks broken up. What do you think?
I think that Mr. Kashkari's study of, I think of it as sort of a broader agenda, as exploring how much safer are we really in the wake of Dodd-Frank, the act that was passed in 2010 to try to make the financial system safer. How effective has those measures been, and whether or not further measures like breaking up large financial institutions are warranted. My own belief going into that process, and I await what comes out of the Minneapolis Fed study with great interest, my own beliefs going into that are that breaking up the banks are really not going to be helpful in that regard. You know, I think from my own take of what happened in 2008 and thereafter is essentially we all got fooled into thinking our houses were going to be worth a lot more now than they turned out to be. I just sold my house in Minneapolis, and I could tell you, it sold for a lot less than I hoped when I bought it in 2005. Hmm. I think we all made that kind of mistake. Those kinds of mistakes can be very – when we make them all together, that can be very harmful for the economy.
Well, are we safer, though? I mean, a lot of the big banks failed their stress tests.
I think a lot is exaggeration. I think that
the very fact
that we have a stress test means that we have ways of making sure how safe we are. I think the fact that we have those kinds of institutions in place means that we have a better signaling system of knowing where the problems are going to be. But my own view is that it's really like a situation where you've had a fire in your neighborhood. You can start to keep track of making sure, having better fire wardens, so to speak, go through the houses to make sure there are less risks. That's one response. I think Dodd-Frank has done a good job of that. That doesn't mean you're never going to have a fire again in your neighborhood. And I think the other response is, do we have the right kind of reaction systems to a fire taking place? In particular, has monetary policy responded in the wake of the crisis as effectively as it could? These are also questions that we should be asking, as well as have we done as much as we can to prevent fires from taking place?
You have written a fair amount about increasing inequality. Do you think the Fed can play a role in decreasing it? Should it?
I think through its achieving of its goals, it definitely helps to play a role in reducing inequality. If you're able to foster and facilitate a more rapid return to full employment from a situation where you have high unemployment, I think that really is helpful in terms of lowering inequality. My goal in the pieces I've written about inequality have really been to try to get some facts on the table. You know, one set of facts is that, in fact, the big increase in inequality in wealth didn't take place after the Fed's more extraordinary policy initiatives, like the so-called quantitative easing. It took place before that, during the downturn, during 2007 to 2010. So you had a very big increase. The poorer Americans took a much bigger hit to their wealth than richer Americans.
Well, is that to counter the idea that, say, QE3 or whatever helped people at the top because they are more entrenched in the markets?
I'm describing the facts, and people can take away from them what they want. My own reading of that is that, boy, if we could have done more to blunt the impact of the recession, and not have such a deep recession 2007 to 2010, that would have been the most effective thing we could have done to keep inequality from growing over the last 6 or 7 years.
What would you do?
You know, I think that the Fed over this time frame in terms of monetary policy took a lot of very beneficial steps. But with the benefit of hindsight, I wish we had taken some of those steps more rapidly. You know, you talk about the launching of large-scale asset purchases. You talked about QE3 or QE2. Why wasn't there just one big QE? As I say, with the benefit of hindsight, I was on the committee, so it is with the benefit of hindsight. Going into the next crisis, the next event of this kind, I hope that future Feds learn from the experiences of this one and are able to move with more alacrity to try to blunt the impact of such a deep recession.
We currently have the first female Fed chair, but all of the Fed governors are white. 3 of the 5 are men. Do you think that we need a Fed that looks more like the rest of this country?
The whole notion of the Federal Reserve is about the idea that diversity is a good thing in the making of monetary policy. That's why we have representatives from around the country. And the act charges the president and the Senate with appointing members of the Board of Governors who are representative of a wide range of walks of life. Yeah, I think it would be good to have a Fed that racially was more representative, a Federal Open Market Committee in particular, that was more representative of the diversity we have in this country.
I mean, because I look at the effects of the recession and certainly in the labor market and see the disproportionate impact on minorities. And I wonder, gosh, was that something you guys talked about when you were on the committee?
So, you know, I'm only able to talk about what happened in 2009, 2010, because everything yep. else remains private. But in 2010, I went through the transcripts, again, with the benefit of hindsight, and really there was no mention of African-American unemployment, for example, which was extraordinarily high during that time frame. Part of that could be attributable to the lack of diversity you describe. Part of it is just the way I think the policy conversation gets framed. We talk about the diversity in the economy that has been set up for us historically to talk about. If you read through the transcripts, it's a very structured conversation. I think there are very easy steps to highlight minority unemployment more in with the presentations that are made to the committee that would immediately, I think, bring this more to the committee's attention. With that said, I think that it would be a good thing for the FOMC to be, in terms of racial diversity, to be more reflective of the kind of great diversity we have in this country.
Arianna Kocher-Lakota, professor of economics at the University of Rochester, former president of the Minneapolis Fed. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the great questions.